It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and for once I'm actually recording at home on a Sunday afternoon. And to join me today is Miss Chelsea Spallin of Shoulders Up. How are you, Mom?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing, well, all right. I'm slightly deaf, but I can hear you, so that's the main thing. How are you doing?
You know, I had a good lazy Saturday yesterday. I had brunch and went to a house party, and then I came home and watched a bunch of wrestling for this podcast, so my weekend is going okay so far.
There you go. That's pretty cool for me, as far as I can tell.
Right. Yeah, you know, you could do better, you could do worse. Than having a bunch of booze and a bunch of caffeine and then watching a bunch of wrestling.
Well, we watched a lot of wrestling because we watched a 4.5-hour show. Now, I know we did say we'd probably have a look at Best of Super Juniors this week, but none of us had time to watch everything. So we're going to save it till the pay-per-view's finished and the event's finished. But we thought in its space, as we're moving on into 1995 and the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling, we should look at one of the biggest cards in 1995 and one of the biggest events in junior heavyweight wrestling, which was the Super J Cup from 1995. Now, anyone who watched New Japan in the last couple of years know the Super J Cup is a single elimination junior heavyweight tournament. Now, this one wasn't held in New Japan Pro Wrestling. It was held in Wrestling Association R. And if you go back in the Beginner's Guide, we've talked about Wrestling Association R, or WAR, before, when it was wrestling and romance. It was Jinichiro Tenryu's promotion that when he left Super World Sports and started his own company, which is based more or less around him, he founded a company that was very, very strong in the heavyweight division because it had him and not many other people. But actually, his junior heavyweight division was one of the strongest junior heavyweight divisions in the world at the time. And its main attraction, Ultimo Dragon, was also the lead booker for the junior heavyweight division. So, looking at this overall card before we start, Chelsea, is there any differences between this and the presentation of junior heavyweight wrestling you've seen from this particular time period? Or is it just kind of cool?
Ooh, differences. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. When I looked at this card, the thing that stood out to me right away was, I was like, oh, Jushin Thunder Liger is going to fight Ultimo Dragon. I got to see that. Because, I mean, I think of those two guys as being not just, obviously, you know, this is like a time when they were doing some of the best work of their career, but also I think of the two of them as like two of the greatest junior heavyweights, you know? Are juniors, am I using that term correctly?
Yes, junior heavyweights, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. I think of the two of them as being, you know, some of the best junior heavyweights. I mean, I think of Jushin Thunder Liger as having like a really definitive style. I think of Ultimo as having a really definitive style. Both of those guys have innovated a bunch of stuff that popularized certain things that are now like tenets of those styles today. So that was a thing that really stood out to me as being something really exciting about this card. Also interesting to me was the fact that Chris Jericho is on this show. I am not used to watching 1990s Chris Jericho in Japan, because most of the work of his that I've watched is from him either in WCW or WWE. So that was something I was interested in going into this card. It's kind of hard for me to characterize what I think of as the junior style in wrestling at the time elsewhere, because I know that junior style was very popular, but I don't necessarily know that it was as neatly categorized as being separated from heavyweight style. Does that make sense? Like, I don't necessarily know. I think wrestling was still trying to figure out what that was and how to define it in this period. Does that make sense?
I think so. I mean, I think there was starting to be a much greater separation between what a heavyweight was and a junior heavyweight was in this era. I mean, you only have to look at Ultimo Dragon in the sense of he wanted to be a wrestler for New Japan Pro Wrestling, but was told he wasn't big enough and ended up having to ship himself off to Mexico to learn how to wrestle and then came back. And, you know, it's another one of those outcast stories. He became the mainstream because he'd had to outcast himself to get himself a job. in the field of work he wanted to be in. And I think that certainly kind of like drives this Japanese lucha kind of style that Gran Hamada had kind of pioneered a few years before. And you've got people in this tournament who are really moving that style forward. I mean, obviously, you've got Ultimo Dragon, you've got Gran Naniwa, you've got, who was the other one? I was thinking, Hanzo Nakajima as well from Ichinoku Pro. These guys are really pushing that Lucha Libre style into the Japanese wrestling. Whereas, like, maybe, you know, 10 years before, you had Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask, who were very different to what the heavyweights were doing, but it was kind of like a smaller version of what the heavyweights were doing. They were the kind of blueprint for what this would become, and they were massively influential on the wrestlers in this tournament. Because I've talked to one of them, that was Ultimo Dragon, and he said his favorite English wrestler was Dynamite Kid. So you can tell that the influence is there, and you're starting to see that separation. What strikes me as interesting about this tournament is basically New Japan didn't have time to run it, so they asked Wrestling Association R, who they had a deal with at the time, to run this particular tournament for them. And it gave them a different feel. But I like the fact that you've got so many different companies represented in this tournament. Whereas when it was a New Japan tournament, you're obviously going to have more New Japan wrestlers because they had a much bigger roster. What do you think of this mix of talent in this particular show?
Oh, man. Stylistically, this is all over the place. There are some guys that I've seen when we watched other things from FMW, who I recognized and thought, wow, what are they doing here? It's not something I would think of, you know, I'm thinking, of course, comparing this to Best of Super Juniors in my head, sort of as a, you know, as a frame of reference while I'm watching it. There are some guys who are obviously like the gaijin who are in Japan studying Japanese wrestling and seeing their North American style kind of trying to adapt itself to this was really interesting. Obviously the lucha influence, like you just talked about, is huge. But it's also really interesting to me that, particularly, I mean, any card that has Jushin Thunder Liger, you're going to think about tokusatsu inspired wrestling, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really interesting to me, not just that that's present in this card, but also how seriously the audience takes it. You know, because I feel like a lot of that stuff, at least now, I think a lot of times people kind of treat that as something that is more silly, more comedic, like not something to be taken seriously. And I don't feel like that's how this crowd reacts to it, watching it in this card. I feel like those stories are told in this card in a way that is meant to be emotionally resonant for the most part. And that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that was like, especially as I got towards the final, everyone had bought into this show, hadn't they? It was like the watching the final, we'll not spoil the ending for you now at the beginning of the show, but watching the final three matches, the near falls, everyone's counting along with the near falls, everyone's into the matches. They really sold this tournament as a complete package. And the final is a surprising pairing, but we'll get to that towards the end. But it doesn't detract anything just because it's not two people you'd expect in the final.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the further you get into this card, the more, like you said, the more and more into it the crowd is. The crowd takes this so seriously. It feels like it's like life or death, you know? It's that really cool thing you get where the audience really wants to be entertained.
Yes, definitely. I would completely agree with that. Right then, shall we start on this tournament? Well, the first match was, speaking of things that you perhaps shouldn't take so seriously, was Damien 666 of Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, and he had his first round match against Gran Naniwa of Michinoku Pro, the Crab Monster. And you can imagine, Satan versus the Crab Monster wouldn't be that great. But actually, this was a ton of fun, and it was awesome, because I love Damien 666, and I love Gran Naniwa, and they had a pretty cool comedy wrestling match that actually did not look out of place and was still competitive, I thought. What did you think, Chelsea?
I thought this was hilarious. Damien 666 does this thing where he shouts the name of a wrestler and then does one of their signature moves. And me describing that to you, listening to this, if you haven't watched him, you probably think that sounds stupid, right? Like, it sounds like, oh, why wouldn't anybody enjoy that? But it's actually hilarious and awesome.
Yeah.
I have no idea why it works as well as it does, but it does. And Naniwa is one of those wrestlers where it's really easy to not take him seriously when you first see him. And then as soon as you see him in the ring, he can go. Like, these two clearly are both really, really good. They had a lot of fun with this. It's a good comedy match. But by the end of it, I was watching it thinking, I would watch those two have a serious match.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they both have the chops. They can both pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the thing I thought of when I was talking a couple of weeks ago about the Wrestle Queendom card. It's kind of similar to Jetta versus Chris Wolf in the sense you've got two very good people at very contrasting styles, but they know how to make their stuff work, and therefore they know how to make each other's stuff work.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I agree.
Okay, the next match was Shinjiro Otani, a man we haven't talked too much about, but it was absolutely phenomenal junior heavyweight. This was his second Super J Cup, and he took on Masakiya Mochizuki, if I spell that right, or Mochizuki?
Masaki Mochizuki.
Mochizuki. I think, thank you very much for that. Shinjiro Otani, I absolutely adored at the time. I was watching a lot of his matches on the old Ring Warriors show on Eurosport. And he's such a great wrestler. I just love his character. There's a lot of him that ended up being in a lot of wrestlers you see lately. Like Katsuyori Shibata took a lot of what Shinjiro Otani did with his character. The black boots, the black tights, shoot shoes, not boots, no socks. Very serious, straight ahead wrestler who could match his big strikes with big submissions, but can actually aerial wrestle just as any good as anyone else in this particular division at the time, which is saying something, because this is probably the best aerial wrestling division ever created anywhere in the world. So this was a lot of fun to see these two together. Didn't last very long, and we ended up with a submission. So what did you think of these two, Chelsea?
I thought this was great. When this ended, I wanted more of it. Even though I could tell that, you know, we still had like 3 hours and 50 minutes of the card left to go. I thought, wow, I could definitely stand to see those two have a much longer match. They beat the crap out of each other. Like, even those submissions looked pretty stiff. I appreciated that the crowd really kind of got going by the end of this too, which was, you know, that's always rewarding when you see guys who are really putting they're back into it and the crowd is with them and invested in both of them. I don't think I had really seen Otani that much before this, but I totally agree. Like, he was really, really good. He is very charismatic. And, you know, now that you've mentioned the comparison to Shibata, I totally see it. I completely get it. Because, like, Shibata, I always think of as having that thing where before he does anything, when he just comes out and walks to the ring and gets in the ring and stands there, you look at him and you're like, that guy is about something. Something really exciting is going to happen. And I think Otani kind of has the same vibe.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it he's a guy, he's got a look on his face that something good's going to happen in this match, isn't it? It's just like, he's got that kind of badass look about him. He doesn't look particularly tough. He's kind of gangly. His kind of coordination's a little bit off, but his facial expressions are absolutely awesome. He wrestles as a heavyweight now, by the way. He's the president of Wrestle One. So Zero One.
Cool.
Zero One, not Wrestle One, Zero One. He helped found Zero One with Shinya Hashimoto. He was kind of the junior heavyweight booker when Hashimoto got fired from New Japan. Otani went with him because he was good friends with him. And then ended up in charge when Hashimoto sadly passed away. So, and he's been in charge ever since and has done a good job. Gave Chris Carino his break in Japan. Right then. The next match was Ultima Dragon, one of the greatest junior heavyweights to ever live, against Japan's finest Green Bay Packers fan, Sho Funaki, who is the current WWE talent relations officer for Japanese talent. Sho, back in these days, had just come off his Michinoku Pro run, but it was before he went to WCW, and he was still a very talented, very good wrestler, like a lot of the guys at the Michinoku Pro dojo. And in fact, you don't realize this, but Michinoku Pro had Great Sasaki, who's still batshit crazy after all these years and still doing crazy stuff. They had Akushi, who went on to his WWE run. That's Jinshei Shinzaki, who is currently the president of Sendai Girls and has done all sorts of things in the wrestling industry. They had Sho Funaki. They had Dick Togo. They had Kaz Hayashi, who currently wrestles in All Japan but had a big run in WCW. All of these guys came from Michinoku Pro, and they did. You don't realize it until 20 years later, but they had a massive effect on how pro wrestling worked.
That's really cool.
And there's Ultimo Dragon, who's, you know, Ultimo Dragon, the living legend himself. At this point, the lead booker of World Wrestling Association R. He was also going to go on and form Dragon Gate, well, not the company that would become Dragon Gate in a few years' time. And this was really Dragon at his most creative. And to be fair to him, he was pretty selfless as a booker in this tournament. You know, Funaki, like, runs rings around him for the first 10 minutes of this match, even though Dragon looks like he only just pulls it out. So it was very generous to give a visiting wrestler, someone who wasn't really of main event standard like Funaki, so much time. What did you think of this match?
I really enjoyed this. I think I wrote in my notes was like whiplash from the stylistic shift. Like,
yeah,
there's so much variety in this card. It's really interesting. I was not really used to seeing Funaki at this period in his career. I've obviously seen some of the stuff he did for WWE, and I have seen him, you know, he's at the Japanese commentary table at every pay-per-view, and he hangs out for the Japanese talent to translate things for them. But it was cool seeing him when he was younger, actually getting in the ring and doing some cool stuff. I thought the stylistic clash between the two of them was interesting. I was surprised when Funaki was so dominant for the first half. I don't know. Ultimo Dragon, you could tell he was kind of saving some of the juice he would need for later.
Yeah.
But he's still a very exciting performer. I mean, that guy can do, you know, like a really simple head scissors, and you look at it and go, "Oh, wow." Because he just makes it look so convincing and amazing. I think that this match is probably, it doesn't stand up compared to some of the other really exciting stuff on this card, but when I was watching it, I still thought it was really interesting and good. I also think that it lasted like the exact right amount of time. It wasn't too short, it wasn't too long, it just did what it said on the tin.
Yeah, I think that's about right. You know, this show was spaced out over two nights. It wasn't a four-hour show in one sense. It ended up being 4 hours of videotape. But, you know, there's plenty of wrestling to see, so you don't have to kind of stretch stuff, do you? You've got plenty to fit in.
Yeah.
Okay, then. The next match was an interesting one, because it was Masayoshi Motegi, who was at the time the NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion, and he was wrestling a guy you may have heard of, Gedo, of the world-class tag team Gedo and Jedo, and at the time known as F*** You, We're Gedo and Jedo. Which was their pie-selling t-shirt of this particular period. I wish they'd bring that back myself, because it's just the best t-shirt
ever. I mean,
ever.
Why not? It just seems like the perfect time in wrestling for it.
Yeah. And Gedo was accompanied by Jedo, his ever-present shadow, and his boss in Kodo Fuyuki, who was the leader of Fuyuki-gun in Wrestling Association R, and would later be accompanied by one Chris Jericho, because he was also a member of Fuyuki-gun. But we'll move on from here. This was a fantastic match, and Gedo starts to tell this story of a guy who's in control. You know, he's not scared. He's not frightened. He's going into this tournament as one of the favorites because he was the finalist the year before in 1994. And he kind of treats his opponents not with disdain. There's a respect there, but it's certainly kind of like about to get business done. We've got to get things done here. This is what we're here to do. And this match with Motegi starts off on a bad step because Motegi ditches his usual knee-length tights for the traditional kind of style that Gedo prefers, with the crop top and the baggy pants of the traditional Japanese kind of fighting style, which doesn't go down well with our Gedo, does it?
No.
What did you think of this one?
I sort of don't know how to feel about this. I am not a huge fan of Gedo as a wrestler, and I kind of thought that would be different watching more of his work from when he was younger. You know, maybe some of that is just that a lot of times when I see him in New Japan now, I kind of roll my eyes because I'm like, I don't want to see you in the ring, dude. Like, just be the guy who shouts about how great Okada is. That's enough for me. But I don't know. There's something, for me, there's something missing there. And that's not necessarily to say that somebody else couldn't watch this and really enjoy it. I mean, I don't know, when he put on that, like, I think it's the Rings of Saturn submission. Yeah. I was watching that and thinking, I don't believe this, really. It doesn't totally hit for me. I don't know. I thought Motegi looked good in this. I liked the successive German suplexes bit. I thought that was cool. The crowd really liked it. But I don't know. When Ghetto won this, I kind of thought, why? It wasn't what I wanted, I guess. I mean, I could tell the crowd didn't agree with me. The crowd really was really invested in his success. And the fact that you said that he was a finalist the year before, that makes sense to me. That they would, you know, because the Japanese fans like love an underdog. They love somebody who comes back, who rises to the top. But I don't know, something about it was just, there was something missing.
Fair enough. I mean, I do like Ghetto as an in-ring performer, and specifically in this time period. And to me, it's fascinating because, you know, he's just come off this run in Wing. Before that, they were in the UWA in Mexico, and then they had time in All Japan and New Japan Pro Wrestling. So to me, it's Gedo. It seems to me, not that Gedo wasn't a good wrestler, I think he was. And I think he was probably underrated. And certainly, he suffered from the thing we've talked about with other people, is the fact that he was really good, but everyone else was so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and that actually might be it.
Yeah.
This card has Jushin Thunder Liger in his prime and Ultimo Dragon on it, and Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit. And there's all these guys on this card who are like in the history books, you know,
legendary
of like
status.
Some of the greatest of their generation. How can you stand up against that?
But equally, I also think that to me, as I watch these matches, this is the apprenticeship to the great booker he becomes. You know, you can't have Gedo today, who makes all these right decisions about New Japan Pro Wrestling, without him going through all of this to figure out what is good wrestling, what is good stories. You know that he's a big fan of Memphis wrestling, he's a big fan of certain styles of wrestling, and the only reason why he is because he met all these wrestlers in his career. You know, he has this,
that's true,
you know, this background and wealth of knowledge, because the majority of professional wrestlers in the time of this time period worked for one company, and that was it, from cradle to grave. And they didn't. Mm. They were the ultimate rebels. They went and worked for everybody else before they settled down on New Japan Pro Wrestling.
That's a really good point. And also, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I think New Japan has, of all the wrestling companies I've watched, some of the best booked tournaments that exist in professional wrestling right now. A lot of times when I watch tournament events in wrestling, you know, you get kind of like, maybe the first half makes sense, and then the second half is kind of like, how did that end up being where we got down to it? I'm looking at Ring of Honor with some pretty serious side eye right now as I say that, because every time they have a tournament, I never understand why anybody wins it the way they do. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it makes sense that that Gedo had to kind of go all over the place to get the experience that he has now.
And you have to look at the guys that taught him how to book tournaments, Jushin Thunder Liger and Ultimo Dragon.
Mm.
You know, he's Liger's boss now, but there was a time when Gedo worked for Liger. You know, Liger will have taught him an awful lot.
That's kind of cool.
Moving on to the next match, El Samurai makes his second consecutive appearance against Dos Caras from Mexico, CMLL. For those of you who don't know who Dos Caras is, he's probably more famous now as Alberto El Patron's dad.
Yes.
Yes. The nice one of the family. Let's call him that. I don't know what Alberto El Patron's brother's like, but, you know. Anyway, Dos Caras, he's a good guy. And I thought this was a really interesting clash of styles. I always get the feeling with Samurai that sometimes he's just hanging around to have another match with Jushin Liger, because when he has a match with Jushin Liger, he's absolutely phenomenal. But, you know, in this case, with particularly with Dos Caras, it was very, very good, and it kind of showed off both their styles really well. I kind of forgot how good Dos Caras was, to be honest with you. I enjoyed this. What did you think?
I thought this was good. I thought Dos Caras was the standout performer in this. El Samurai, I totally agree. Like, I've seen two or three things he's been in, mostly, I think, in stuff I've watched for our podcasts. And when he's against Liger, he's a magician. And a lot of the rest of the time, I just don't care about him. I did not get super invested in him here. He gets really beat up, and he sells it okay. There are some really weird submissions in this match that I just... I watched them and I thought, I'm not sure if Zack Sabre Jr. would sign off on that. You know, like, I just, you know, or like Minoru Suzuki would not be a fan. I don't really think either of these guys are great submission wrestlers. I'm not really sure why they did as much submissions or as many submissions as they did.
I think Dos Caras obviously comes from that Mexican Lucha Libre style of submission, which is very, very different to... It's kind of like a more showy submission style. It's stuff that looks really dangerous rather than stuff that actually is really dangerous. And a lot of the Lucha Libre stuff looks more realistic than it actually is. He managed to pick a bunch of moves that didn't look any more realistic than they are. He did better in the second round. His submissions in the second round were pretty good. And also, like Alberto El Padron, he's actually a serious shooter, so he does know what he's doing when it comes to, like, you know, defending himself in a straight-up fight. So it's kind of, it is a bit weird that a guy who has a background in submissions picks submissions that don't look that deadly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like go with a simple armbar next time or something, man. It was like this wasn't awful, but it's just it doesn't hold up with the rest of this card for me. There's a lot of better stuff on this card.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right, then, the final match of the first round, and you may have noticed we had some names missing, which I'll explain in a moment, was Lionheart, better known to you as Chris Jericho, who defeated Hanzo Nakajima from Michinoku Pro. And it was a pretty even-handed matchup with Chris Jericho coming out on top. Jericho, like I said, was part of Yukigun. He was a heel, and he did some heelish things. And there was all sorts of things in this particular match that I kind of went back in my head and went, yeah, we saw that at Wrestle Kingdom, and we're probably going to see it next month as well. It was a lot of fun. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
I am surprised when I watch young Chris Jericho how much I prefer a lot of the stuff he's doing in his career now, which is weird. I know that a lot of people, it's kind of the reverse is true, possibly because they grew up with him. But I just got really tired of him watching this particular match, you know, with his like yelling at the crowd and "Are you ready?" I was like, I don't care, man. Just wrestle. It's fine. I think this was like a good by the numbers, you know, serviceable match. I don't think it was it didn't leave a huge impression on me. I know that Jericho goes on to do more interesting stuff later in this tournament, and I could tell, like, watching it. I was like, Chris Jericho's gonna win this, right? Yeah, okay. I don't know that I got a really good impression of Nakajima as a wrestler.
No.
I thought he was fine, but he didn't really resonate with me as anything really special. I don't know what he did before or after this. I don't know if I've ever seen him before.
No, I haven't either, to be honest. I know, I think I've probably seen him on a couple of Michinoku Pro tapes, but yeah, he was just good. He was just a solid wrestler, which is the kind of guy you wanted at this particular point to get Chris over, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, this era of Chris Jericho tends to remind me more of the first heel Chris Jericho before he became Master of 1001 Holds and, you know, the big talky Chris Jericho when he first turned heel. This was kind of like the genesis of that for me, because I don't think he knew what he was doing to be a heel, to be honest with you.
No, I don't know that Chris Jericho always knew when he was a heel in this period. Like, what I mean by that is, I think he's a really obnoxious jerk sometimes in a lot of the matches I've watched him in from the 90s. But I don't know that he knew that he was being an obnoxious jerk.
No, the first match we saw him in Japan was in 1993 when that opener of the FMW anniversary show, where I can't remember who he's tagging with, but they look like an organized tag team because they're wearing matching gear, but they are so annoying.
Yeah.
They're clearly trying to be babyfaces, but they're the most annoying tag team I've ever seen. And it's just like, we were not paying to see you?
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah. I don't know. And what's funny is, I feel like that super, super annoying, very egotistical, quote-unquote babyface guy is a thing that was really popular with Western wrestling fans.
Yeah.
And in this time period. And I think that's why it's an archetype that Vince McMahon refuses to let go of as a booker nowadays.
Yeah. I think it's it's intriguing, and it was essentially what Chris Jericho was being by accident in Japan.
Mm.
Anywho, we move on to the quarterfinals. Now, you may have noticed that we missed some big names out of junior heavyweight wrestling, most notably Jushin Thunder Liger. Well, they got a bye so that, you know, you matched your numbers up, and it gave a little bit of, like, anticipation, because obviously if you've got a Jushin Liger and Chris Benoit in the second round, you're going to have some different and interesting matches. So the first match with Jushin Thunder Liger was Gran Naniwa. Now, I have to say, I never thought I wanted to see Gran Naniwa versus Jushin Thunder Liger, but I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was fantastic, and I wish they'd wrestled each other more. Liger wins with a Fisherman Buster, which was the move of this tournament, because everyone was pulling out Fisherman Busters at this point, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
Oh, man, I used the fire emoji about 5 times when I was taking notes for this match. this is so cool. Naniwa comes out with crab claws on, like he's a tokusatsu character. And Liger, when he comes out, he has the swooshing, swirling silver cape. And I don't know where this music came from, but I love this entrance music for him. And the crowd is like super excited, and I think they seemed to know all the words, like there were people singing along. And then Liger doesn't even get to fully capitalize on that moment of standing on the turnbuckle and I'm here, everybody, I'm here to save the day, when Naniwa just comes at him with a dropkick. Just like, hey, we're gonna start this right now, I'm gonna kick your ass. And it sets the tone for how the rest of this goes. Like, they do not give each other an ounce of slack or breathing room in this whole thing. Even when they're doing submissions, it feels very, very tense. And the crowd reacts to absolutely everything. Everything. Like, there's a point where Liger goes to put it almost looks like he's going to do a surfboard, but then he doesn't. He kind of bends Naniwa backwards, almost like over his shoulder. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to call it. I don't know what that move is called or if it has a name. But he does it, and when he just gets Naniwa's feet, like, kind of wrapped up for the first part of the move, you can hear the crowd go, oh.
Yeah.
Like, in unison.
Because they know the surfboard's coming, but then he cuts it off halfway through.
right. And so they're waiting for it. You can feel them waiting for it. And then when Naniwa breaks out of it, he goes to put Liger into a submission. And it looks like he's going to do a surfboard. And once again, the crowd is like, oh, you know, they're really excited about it. I mean, it's actually, the crowd noise during this match is as entertaining as the match itself, by the way. Like, I really enjoyed how thoroughly invested they are. And then, once again, they tease the surfboard, but don't do it. And I was like, man, I've never been so hungry to see a surfboard before. Because I think of that as being, like, such a silly move. But also, I mean, I know it's something that Liger is known for. I really love this match. I thought this match was one of the coolest things on this card. I did not really know that Naniwa had this in him. Like, I knew he was a really good wrestler. But I did not realize that when he was in there with Jushin Thunder Liger, that he could hold his own and stand up. Because, I mean, Liger was, like, you know, so epic at this point, and he had had that successful manga series, so everybody knew who he was separate from his wrestling career, and, you know, he was doing all this really incredible stuff that was defining the genre of wrestling he was performing in. So, I mean, I think if anybody can have one of those matches where, you know, it's not just like they come across as looking good, but where you're thinking, wow, that guy's a perfect opponent for this guy who I think of as one of the greatest, you know, I think that really says a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
I could definitely watch those two have more matches. I didn't Google to see if they ever did, but I'm hoping that they did, because I thought this was awesome.
Yeah, I absolutely adored this match for the same reason you're saying. It's just like, it's so surprising. I know Naniwa's great, and he's great at all sorts of different things, but like, the idea that he would have this great, superb technical wrestling match with Jushin Thunder Liger is just like, it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? It's like,
it casts against type.
Yeah, I mean, I was like flicking through Twitter this morning, and someone, remember when IWA Mid-South booked Eddie Guerrero versus Rey Mysterio versus CM Punk? And it's like, no, I don't, funnily enough. And I don't think anyone else does either, but that actually happened, and here is video footage of them three wrestling each other in a triple threat.
Oh, I actually, you know, it's funny, I actually have seen that, because a little tiny bit of it is in the CM Punk documentary that WWE did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was really surprised to find out that Punk had ever wrestled Eddie Guerrero when I watched it, so I went and I looked it up.
Yeah, it's just like you don't expect those things happen, but they kind of must have done because there's only so many combinations of wrestlers in so many promotions, and eventually they do have to happen. But yeah, just refreshingly awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
All right, the next match was Shinjiro Otani taking on Ultimo Dragon in a battle of two of the guys who were genuinely considered the best junior heavyweights in the world, and they both kind of have a clash of styles here, but it works so well. You know, Otani's trying to go back to the ground and pound because he clearly wants Dragon on the mat because he knows he's dangerous in the air. Equally, Dragon is wary of Otani's aerial offense and his strikes, so this tension builds up into a match that just goes on and still building layers and building layers, and is just magical. And I love this match. Chelsea, what did you think of it?
This is really, really good. This is Ultimo Dragon at his most, like, it's peak Ultimo Dragon. It's all the stuff you really, really want from him. Or not, maybe not all of it, but a lot of it. And Otani is really, really good here. Like, he shines, they both do. I am surprised by the fact that there weren't more high spots between the two of them that were, like, I sort of think of Dragon as being somebody who does those really competitive high spot bits where it's not just like, how do I explain? There are a lot of wrestlers who can do really amazing aerial stuff where they'll do one high spot and the question is, can the other guy kick out? You know? And one of the things I like about good super juniors wrestlers, or not super juniors, but good juniors wrestlers, is that a lot of times those high spots feel competitive in a way that's not just related to, you know, can he score a pinfall? It's like, who can show off what they can do the most?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I don't know, they know that that's a thing that you're waiting for in this match, but they don't give it to you right away. And I thought that was really, really smart. I really enjoyed the bit where Otani reverses the powerbomb and then goes for the roll-up and comes, you know, sort of like comes back even stronger than he did before, and the crowd goes like really, really wild when they hear it. I was really surprised actually to see Dragon do this much mat wrestling.
Yeah.
Because I know he can do it. I know he can do it. But it's not something I expect from him. I mean the Dragon suplexes I marked a little bit. I really enjoyed that. And yeah, what is the thing with the Fisherman's Buster in this match? Is that you mentioned it before. Is that a thing? Because I put that in my notes. I was like, there's a lot of Fisherman's Busters this tournament.
There seemed to be, like, in that particular period, there was kind of like a fashion for certain things, usually because either Liger or Dragon had done them. So there was a fashion for Fisherman Busters. Like 6 months before, it was Frankensteiners from the top rope, because Liger kind of invented that. He was the first to invent the top rope DDT as well. Though, obviously, for obvious reasons, it's not the safest maneuver in the world, and that one didn't catch on so well. You know, so there is all sorts of, like, because Liger was so inventive, I think, there was kind of like a fashion for certain things to happen, and if Liger could do it, then everyone else had to be able to do it. So, you know, and I think that's really where guys like Gedo and guys like Naniwa, because their styles were so different, and they kind of didn't want to copy anybody else, they did their own thing, that's what made them stand out in their era, I think.
That's really cool. I thought the ending of this match was really amazing, too. Like, Dragon doing that, what do they call it? The Sky Twister?
Sky Twister thing? Press, the, yeah.
Yeah, the Sky Twister Press, and then the cradle for the pin at the end is so cool. Like, it's one of those moments where, I mean, the crowd gasped, and so did I. I thought this match was really interesting and really fun. I think if you're trying to pick stuff to watch from this card, this is a good one for sure.
Yes, I agree with you. One thing we haven't talked about, we're getting to Gedo again now. Gedo's hair in this particular match. And this particular
card. Wait, did we skip something?
No, we haven't skipped anything. Just Gedo's hair.
What about the order that I have? I'm not on cage match, but I have Benoit and Jericho in this round.
I have that as the
did
last
that happen
one.
Later?
Yeah, that happened later.
Oh, okay. Mine must be out of order.
Okay. Yes, Gedo's hair. It was coiffed quite well, I thought. He's moved on from the shaved sides and the mullet, and he got a nice rock and roll quiff going on there. I wanted to mention that.
We do. This is the wrestling podcast where we talk a lot about hair.
Indeed. And we still have to do that podcast based around LIJ's hair for Chrissy.
We should. We should.
Anyway, in the next semi-final, Dos Caras took on Gedo. And it was a different kind of match. It was Gedo trying to tell the story of he was picking his spots and he waited for his moment and he managed to deliver a low blow and get the win and get the hell out of there because he knows he needs to get to the final. He's got a lot of wrestlers to face. He didn't want to muck it around with Dos Caras, who puts him into all sorts of submission predicaments. So trying to get out of the match, he manages to get a low blow in when the referee is distracted, and that's how he wins the match. And the fans booed, but it told the story of Gedo the opportunist trying to get to where he was before, and I liked this match for this particular story. It wasn't the most interesting wrestling match, but from a story, I really enjoyed it. What did you think of it, Chelsea?
Yeah, I thought this was fine. I agree that the story was good. I think by the time I got to this, I was kind of like impatient to get it over with because I wanted to see what was going to happen in the semifinal.
Yeah.
I do think Gedo shows that he's a really good storyteller in this match. Like, he understood what was needed and he pulled it off. It's not one of the more emotionally resonant moments in the tournament for me, but it does what it's supposed to do to move the story forward.
Yes, exactly. All right, then. The next match in the final match was the return of Chris Benoit to this particular tournament, and he wrestled Chris Jericho. Now, I still have a hard time watching Chris Benoit matches, and this was still an uncomfortable watch for me. But I still, you know, at this particular time period, Chris Benoit was my favorite wrestler. I loved and adored him for what he was doing in Japan and for what he was doing in Europe and all over the world. And he was such a fantastic wrestler, but it is still emotional and hard work for me to watch because of the obvious, we know the end of this story, and it's not good. But what did you think of the match, Chelsea?
So these two have really amazing chemistry. If I didn't know that Jericho and Benoit were friends, I would have guessed it from the way they wrestle each other. The way they wrestle each other is amazing. It's, you have that thing where Jericho is like really annoying and very fiery, and Benoit is just like total straight man in response, like very icy. I don't know how to feel watching Benoit wrestle, and it's not, I don't, you know, I wasn't someone who grew up watching him and then was a fan of his before what happened, you know, when his, when everything happened. So I don't have that history there, but the thing is, when I watch him, he wrestles like a vicious killer. And I think that's why I have a hard time watching it, is because I'm sort of like, that turned out to be the person he was in real life too, somehow. Yeah. I don't know. This is a good match and they have a lot of chemistry together. And if you're someone who likes both of these guys, I would recommend it. But if Chris Benoit makes you uncomfortable, this match will make you uncomfortable.
Yes,
because
very much so.
He is really, really vicious in it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that comes from his background. I mean, his great hero was the Dynamite Kid, and Chris wrestled. Well, Dynamite said he met him at a show one night, and Chris, when he was 12 years old, said, "I want to wrestle exactly like you." And Dynamite said, "Yep, well, very good. Nice to meet you." Da 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 da. But he said he actually did end up wrestling exactly like me. If Dynamite said I think it was about 93 or around this time, that if I was still wrestling, Chris would be doing the things that I was going to do, you know. And Dynamite's not a particularly nice person either. As much as I love his wrestling and his wrestling style, he's not a particularly stable person, and certainly wasn't in this particular time period.
Yeah.
And you know, and again, I don't particularly want to have the conversation about Chris Benoit because now's not the time. But you're right. If it's going to make you uncomfortable, skip this one, and skip the semifinals in as well, because it's like, that's the crisp, hardcore Chris Benoit I knew and loved at the time, but now I'm not so happy that I have those memories, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
Anyway, let's move on to the second, well, the first semi-final, which pitted, as you quite rightly said earlier, Jushin Thunder Liger and Ultimo Dragon in an absolutely fantastic match, as you would expect. I watched a match not long ago from the Tokyo Dome on one of the big shows from this particular time period, and I was blown away by these two. So watching these two have a different match and come up with something completely different again in a different environment that's just about junior heavyweights was absolutely fantastic. And it was just awesome watching this match. It was so cool to watch this match because they were the two best junior heavyweights in the world at the time. And when you've got two people who are the best at something, they can really make magic. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is the Kushida versus Hiromu of its day. Like,
yes.
Oh man, it's beautiful. Like, I mean, as though anything between those two guys could be anything less than amazing. I love that they start this by locking up and pushing each other back and forth, and then it kind of transitions into, I think it's Liger goes for the head scissors, you know, to get out of the lockup, to kind of ease it into, okay, we're moving this forward towards the stuff that we're really known for, that you came here for. And the crowd is on that ride with them, you know, like you can kind of feel that when they lock up, everybody drops down to really, really quiet, you know, waiting for that. They're anticipating that that moment of like, okay, when is this going to get started? And then once it does, it's like everybody follows them there. I like that they tease a lot of the stuff that they're both known for and kind of like don't fully pull it off. Like
yeah.
The surfboard, you know, kind of gets thwarted, and there's some really amazing mat wrestling in the beginning of this. Like, it's really, really cool. I it was fun for me seeing Liger be such a jerk. Like, because I think of Liger as being, you know, at least in terms of the way the crowd feels about him, a lot of times I'm used to seeing him be a babyface.
Yeah.
So seeing Liger be, you know, so vicious and being like, no, I'm not going to let you get one over on me, I hate you, is just kind of amazing. And I mean, of course he doesn't hate Dragon, you can tell, but it's a lot of fun. I love when they crash into each other in midair. That moment is so great because you see wrestlers do that spot a lot now, but it rarely gets the kind of impact that it did when these two do it. When these two do it, it feels special, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I even enjoyed the part where there's the whole thing about the, like, the surprise roll up, and then it gets reversed, and then, you know, the false finish thing is a staple of wrestling now. It's kind of a thing that the audience expects in a lot of big tournament matches now, to the point where there are times where it doesn't feel impactful. And here, watching this, I hadn't read far down enough to see who was going to win the final, so I actually wasn't sure who was going to pull it off, which meant that when the crowd was like gasping along with the, oh my god, false finish, what's going to happen? I was actually kind of right there with them. I was like, I don't know who's going to pull this off. It's really amazing. I really enjoyed the finish of this, where Dragon goes for, is it the magistral? Magistral? I don't know.
Magistral.
Magistral, yeah. And Liger reverses it and is just like, nope, you're done. You're done.
Yeah.
That's it. I thought that was a really creative way to end the match because, you know, they get some of their greatest hits in there, but Liger still ends up looking more dominant of the two, which was, they had to establish a clear victor at the end of this match. It couldn't just be like he escaped with the win. It had to be like one guy really pulled it off, you know?
Yeah.
Otherwise you were going to feel like you were robbed having the other guy absent from the rest of the tournament. So I thought that was really smart.
I think as well, the next match kind of has to have a clean finish for a different reason, because Pegasus, well, if Jado's going through, he has to beat Chris Benoit. He can't just sneak it like he did against Karras in the previous round. He's got to really make a definitive win. And that's the story of this particular match. Again, it's Gedo being the opportunist, looking for momentum, looking for the right moments. He knows he's not technically as good as Chris Benoit. You know, you can see it in his body language. So he's got to try and pick the right moment, and eventually he just out-toughs Benoit to get the win with a brainbuster and a diving headbutt, which is obviously one of Benoit's finishers, which was an interesting choice, and it's not normally it. Well, Ghetto did use the driving headbutt a fair bit, but not as much as Benoit did. So it was an interesting kind of like storytelling device, and it was an interesting way of getting Ghetto over. Obviously, the match is not going to be as technically as good as Liger versus Dragon, but what did you think of this one?
This is... I had, again, conflicting feelings watching this. I thought Ghetto was really amazing in this match, and I don't, like I said before, I don't normally like him. I don't necessarily know that I fully believe that he could beat Chris Benoit.
Yeah.
But I came as close to believing it as possible, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I was almost there, but I don't know. They both go for it so hard in this match. I mean, Benoit comes across as he wants to win and he will rip you apart to get there. And Ghetto almost comes across as like, I mean, not just that he doesn't want to be intimidated, but like maybe even he's a little scared and he's forcing himself to like brave this and tough it out. That was really interesting to me because I don't normally get that much emotion from him, I guess, when I watch him.
No.
The brain buster was a surprise. The swan dive was a surprise. If there's one knock I have on Benoit as a wrestler, it's that I don't know that I really believe a lot of his selling.
Yeah. It's very samey selling. He doesn't vary it much.
It's the same expression, like, yeah. You know, and that's okay, I think, in this match, because Ghetto's performance is emotional enough that the selling becomes sort of secondary.
The
point is that he gets there, not as much, I guess, how you feel during little moments of the match while he's trying to get there. But it's still, I don't know, it was still a weird experience for me watching this, because I feel like if the stuff that had happened in this match had been two other wrestlers somehow having this exact match, I think my feeling about it would have been completely different. I think maybe I just came into this match with too much baggage.
Yeah.
To really appreciate it on its own.
Yeah, because you have, like, one guy you know is going to be one of the biggest players in the industry. You know he's going to be all right. But the other guy is going to create one of the biggest disasters in pro wrestling history. You know, this match, actually, I suppose, really, of people made good in their careers, Ghetto, you can't get much better than that, can you? Lead booker of the second biggest wrestling company in the world and the most successful booker of the last 20 years versus a guy who went on to murder his family. You know, it's horrible to think about, but this match kind of sums up pro wrestling for the next 20 years. Which is really sad in that particular sense. So let's move on to something that actually did define wrestling for the next few years, which was the semi-final match. Now, Rey Mysterio and Psicosis were asked to come and do a match to fill time before the main event. And Ultimo Dragon clearly knew what he was talking about booking these two. They'd had some phenomenal matches in AAA. They'd had some very good matches in ECW. I think this was just slightly before ECW. So, Ultimo Dragon rings up Conan, who was the AAA booker at the time. I want two of your best guys, and he sends them Rey Mysterio Jr. and Psicosis in the middle of their 4-year, 2,000-match-long feud, and they blow their minds of the audience again, because the Japanese fans could not get enough of this. Imagine making your Japanese debut at Sumo Hall in the second biggest match of the night, just before you go on against Gedi versus Jushin Liger in the final of the biggest short format tournament in Japanese wrestling. That's pretty neat, isn't it? And then you go and blow everybody's minds. This introduced pure lucha-style wrestling to a Japanese audience, and it's actually phenomenal to see, because I forgot how fast these two could move. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is insane. This is the really refreshing moment of oh my god, we can forget about the structure of this tournament and just, like, enjoy ourselves thing that the crowd needed to get really invested in the final.
Yeah.
You totally forget about everything else outside of this match while you're watching it. It is so much fun. Rey Mysterio is someone who I've watched a lot of work from later in his career, but I haven't, shamefully, I think, probably watched as much stuff from this period where I think this is before WCW.
Yes, it is.
So I haven't seen as much, and oh my god, like, it is incredible how fast that guy can move, and he's still so smooth when he does all of it. Like, he's so confident. He makes all this really complicated stuff look super, super easy. And Psychosis does the same thing. Like, they're so evenly matched, and they're so compatible, and you don't have that problem where you get two guys who kind of do the same thing, so it's too samey. Because they know how to make all of it really, really, really exciting. It's just, it's really, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind that Rey and Psicosis were 21 at this point.
Yeah.
And they've been wrestling for 5 or 6 years together.
That's nuts, though. That's crazy, though. Being 21 and being that good.
Yeah, and like, Ray's only a couple of months younger than me. He was like, my birthday's in August. His is in December, so he's slightly younger than me. And Psicosis is about the same age as me. Might be slightly older than me, which is, you know, terrible for my ego because it's like, these guys are doing this.
Right, you're like, what's wrong with my life?
Yes, these guys are megastars on television in their home country when they were 15 years old. What have I done wrong? I mean, it's like they used to work for the Tijuana promotion when they first started, and they were doing ludicrous things that no one in their right mind would let them get away with now, but it was Tijuana, so no one cared. And they used to go and rehearse matches on Friday nights because TV tapings were on Saturdays. So if they broke their, they wouldn't do the full moves. They kind of block out what they were going to do, because if you got it wrong, at least you broke your leg on TV instead of breaking your leg in practice.
Jesus Christ.
So they would actually, like, they would try the most ridiculous and stupid things that both of them could come up with, because they knew it would get them over, and eventually AAA picked them up because they'd been watching these insane matches they've been having in Tijuana.
Man.
By which time they'd managed to calm their moveset down to something reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, so this is an incredible, incredible showing of the styles that they do. The one knock I have on it is that I don't know that I got much of a sense that either of them were really feeling anything in terms of their characters.
No, but then again, you have to bear in mind, like, in Lucha Libre, I think when someone described it as, I think Daniel Bryan, I listened to Daniel Bryan interview with Steve Austin, he said he got over everywhere he went because he kind of figured out what the style was. Like, he said, like, in Japan, it's about moves, yes, but it's about fire and having that fire to come back when you need to. And he said, in Europe, it's about technical wrestling, and it's about the way you talk and where you present your wrestling. That's how you get over. And he said, in Mexico, you need good music and some good tights. He said, because no one really cares about the matches. There's no psychology to speak of. They care about who wins and loses. But if you can get hold of people with good tights and good music and a flashy entrance, you're halfway there. And he said, now look at me.
Wow.
Yes. So Daniel Bryan,
you know,
never got over
in
Mexico.
See it. I've seen some footage of that period in Daniel Bryan's career, and he was absolutely ridiculous looking.
Yes. And so it's the same kind of thing here. Is the opposite effect is, you're right, they're not showing much emotion because they just haven't developed their characters, because all these two are about is flashy moves. They happen to be two of the best people who are around at flashy moves, and they can make that the psychology of a match. But there's no psychology to this whatsoever. It's a bunch of spots.
Yeah.
You know, I think
it's really, really good spots, though.
They're just
really
fantastic spots. J.J. Dillon once told Rey Mysterio, when he first signed with WWE, he said, I didn't like watching you wrestle because you were a luchador. And he said, 5 years later, you're a wrestler. And he said that was the difference. He wasn't knocking on Rey when he said that, but he's not knocking on Lucha Libre. But what he was saying is the attitude of Lucha Libre at the time, and specifically less now because it's much more influenced by Western wrestling, was spot.
Right.
Which is not just doesn't happen now. There's a lot more psychology to it because of people seeing what went on.
And a thing that I think is interesting is, like, I think of Rey Mysterio now in stuff that I've seen recently, where he can do something that you've seen him do millions of times, you know, with tons of other opponents. And he can give you the emotional feeling you need to have for that specific character that he's wrestling against.
Yeah.
And that specific match, you know. And I don't really know how it is that wrestlers do those things. It's just kind of the magic of wrestling. But I've seen him have matches. Like, I saw something from a little bit of a match he had with Ricochet, where he gave you this feeling of, like, Ricochet is just one of the best guys in the world, and he can maybe compete with me. And it felt so tense and so competitive. And it's really amazing to think that this guy who we're watching in this match in 1995 on this card grows into somebody who has that weird superpower, where he can do this really amazing, death-defying thing that very few people can do as well as he does it, while also telling you this really full, complete story.
Indeed, yeah. He is so much more of a complete package, even though he can't do half the things he could do at this particular age.
I mean, it does. Yeah, he's so good now, still, it doesn't even matter. It's like, he can still entertain you and make you think he's the best.
Indeed. Oh, then, but speaking of the best, there could only be two finalists, and they were Gedo and Jushin Thunder Liger. And in the end, Jushin Thunder Liger took the win. In a match that was surprisingly emotional and surprisingly in depth, Gedo was trying to sneak the victory again. He was trying to push against the odds to take the title from Liger. He'd lost out the year before, and this was a well-told story of Gedo looking a little bit scared, but trying to figure out where he could pick his spots from. But in the end, Liger was just too much for him. What did you think of this, Chelsea, for a final?
Oof. This is an emotional roller coaster. I feel like the crowd was kind of confused about who it was they wanted to root for, because the crowd loves Liger, but they also love Gato. So I feel like they're cheering just for the fact that the match is happening, not so much because they wanted a particular victor. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To me, to be perfectly honest with you, this was almost a little exhausting for me, like, watching it. By the time I got to the end of it, I was ready for it to be over. I'm not as invested in Gato as a wrestler. So I think there are moments in this match where he does something that should be emotionally resonant with me, but for some reason I'm just not getting there.
Yeah.
And because I strongly prefer Liger, I don't know that I had the feeling of, oh my god, is Gato going to get away with possibly pulling this off, that I was supposed to have.
Yeah.
I think seeing Liger at this point in his career was really, really fun, because he can do so much, and the mat wrestling is so good, the high spots are so good, he can do all the stuff in between, and it's really convincing, and he feels like a real-life superhero. Which is really amazing, especially for somebody who is that short. I think Ghetto's no-selling was kind of frustrating for me watching this match. There are some moments in it, like there's this one moment where Liger does this really incredible-looking dropkick, and Gato no-sells it from the ground. And I was sitting there thinking, that's Jushin Thunder Liger, you should f***ing sell that shit. I don't know. Liger bomb. He does a Liger bomb. It gets a two count. And I'm like, yeah, really? I don't know. I don't really believe that Gato could last this long against Jushin Thunder Liger at his peak. I think both those guys did everything they could do to tell that story. I don't know that I fully bought it.
I think, well, I mean, there's also the point, like, Gato is in home territory because it's so WAR show, not a New Japan show. So I think he has to kick out once of the Liger Bomb just to show that he's defending the company's honor myself. But I agree with you that it's like Gedo isn't the wrestler that Liger is, and I think probably could have stood from a bit more cheating from Gedo to get that over, that he's being the opportunist. He's trying to sneak one if he can get one.
Yeah. I think more cheating would have been good. I think
that's very, very, very unlikely that you'll hear any of us say more cheating would have been good.
I mean, I don't know. It would be like, I'm sorry that all my analogies for these things are WWE related, but it's the thing I have the most frame of reference for. It's like if it would be like if Carmella beat Sasha Banks clean in a match for a title instead of cheating 17 times to pull the victory off. You know? Like, if she somehow managed to successfully pin Sasha for a 3 count, I would just be like, absolutely no way. There's no fucking way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the right guy won this match, I think, because, you know, Liger pulling it off. If Liger hadn't won, I think I would have been mad about it, to be perfectly honest. But, I don't know, I guess my problem with it is really just that I don't like Ghetto. I can tell it's a good match, it's just not a match for me.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And as we said before, you know, we all have different tastes of the Troopini show. It's one of the things that we like about the show is because, like, you like a certain style of thing, and Sai likes dad fights. He's on mum fights at the minute. He's really into mum fights after Wrestle Queendom. That's his new thing. So because we have different tastes, it makes the show interesting. To wrap up, then. What do you think of this tournament, and what do you think of the effect it had on pro wrestling?
Oof. So I think this tournament is really good. I think a lot of the wrestlers in it are amazing, and I think I saw some guys in it who I wasn't prepared for being as good as they were. Like, Naniwa really stood out to me. Otani really stood out to me. It was cool seeing Funaki do stuff that I hadn't seen him do before. That was really fun. I think I understand Gato better now, having watched this tournament. So if you are someone who is trying to go back through the history of New Japan and you want to get a better sense of Gato's career, this is probably something that's really good to watch. Its effect on pro wrestling. Wow. So I'm thinking about, when was it that the cruiserweight style became a thing that was really popular in North America? Was that like 98, 99?
97, I would say. It's just around the time of the NWO, so it's really okay. Well, maybe 96, actually. So, yeah, you're a couple of years away from this, but there's a lot of guys who end up being WCW cruiserweight champions. I mean, obviously, Ultimo Dragon was end up being a TV champion there as well. Shinjiro Otani had time there, obviously, while Pegasus was a champion, a cruiserweight champion. Jushin Liger challenged for that title. Rey Mysterio was on this card, challenged for that title. Gato challenged for that title. Damien 666 had time in WCW. Dos Caras, not so much, no. And obviously, Chris Jericho had a massive run in WCW, but started in the cruiserweight division. So, yes, I would agree with you there.
Yeah, so I don't think you would have any of that stuff without this. I think this particular type of juniors wrestling feels extremely formative for the stuff that happens a couple years later, and it's also a really interesting precursor to where we are now, where I feel like the junior heavyweight style is so much better defined, and in some ways, I think it's more. I don't know how to say it. It's not more high risk, but I think it's flashier now in some ways than some of this is. I think there's a level of technical wrestling that here that I wasn't fully expecting before I started watching it that was really interesting. I think, in terms of its impact on pro wrestling. I think it's really interesting to me how many of the guys from this are guys who are working in wrestling now and leading younger guys towards what they're doing. You know, like, I think of Jericho as someone in WWE who is known for putting young guys over and helping other guys get their foot in the door or helping them maintain their level, you know, their like top star main event status. I think of, obviously, I mean, Liger, a large part of what he does for New Japan is bringing up the young boys, you know, he comes out at the beginning of the show in the costume and the crowd gets really excited for his theme song. And then they watch the Young Lions have their match and they clap politely. You know, I think Liger is obviously somebody who is instrumental in helping those guys learn the ropes. And Gato, I mean, is one of the most powerful people in wrestling because he can book one of the most important, or he books one of the most important promotions in the world. And comes out and yells at people about how great Okada is. You sort of nod, because even though Ghetto is really annoying, it's true. I think that's really interesting, you know, in particular for me, that those three guys are in. Oh, and how do I even forget to mention Ultimo Dragon? Ultimo Dragon is one of those wrestlers that every high flyer who does anything at a high level now tries to copy from time to time, right? Like, half of Seth Rollins' stuff in the beginning of The Shield is him trying to be Ultimo Dragon and not quite pulling it off, but, you know, doing an impressive job of copying some of those moves nonetheless. Which, of course, you know, led to making him the really amazing main event star that he is now, where he's got more of his own style kind of solidified. I think it's really interesting that there are so many guys in this tournament who are so groundbreaking. Because watching it, you can see how much talent there is there. But I think it was probably impossible to look at this in 1995 and know where all of those guys were going to end up.
Well, I can tell you where... who was it? Ultimo Dragon was last night. Last night, it was with one of Joey Janela's shows. And he was wrestling Mike Quackenbush. And he was managed by Sonny Ono.
Oh my god, really? He wrestled Quackenbush?
He wrestled Mike Quackenbush in one of Mike Quackenbush's happiest moments. I've ever seen a picture of him. I've never seen him smile so big. He took a picture. He's not the kind of guy that takes a selfie with a wrestler he's with at the end of a show, but he took a selfie with Ultimo Dragon and Sonny Ono. Because why wouldn't you? Damn it.
I mean, yeah, you fucking have to. That's so beautiful. I'm really happy to know that that happened.
Yeah. I think this is probably one of... Ultimo Dragon's greatest achievements as a booker and as a wrestler. You know, widely considered the 94 show was better than the 95 show. We picked the 95 show purely because you can find it on YouTube. If you put in Super J Cup into YouTube, you can find it free of charge, because Wrestling and Wrestling Association Lyon no longer exists. No one's going to sue anybody for coverage. So, you know, we thought we'd pick this one. But it is this kind of a testament to Ultimo Dragon's booking style and the things he would achieve in pro wrestling in the next 30 years, because he's been around. If you don't have Dragon Gate without Ultimo Dragon, you don't have Japanese Lucha as firmly established in pro wrestling. So guys like Will Ospreay and Ricochet don't really exist without Ultimo Dragon. And, you know, he's a guy who crossed over into mainstream wrestling in the United States of America, wrestled WCW and the WWE, and did an awful lot of things that guys like Shinsuke Nakamura are doing 20 years later, you know, and guys like Asuka and soon to be Io Shirai and Kairi Sane are doing now. Well, he did it a long time ago. So he saw all the pitfalls of what went on and still wrestles all over the world whenever he wants to.
So cool.
Indeed. Well, thank you for listening to us today as we talked about Super J Cup 1995 Second Stage. We thoroughly enjoyed that show. You can watch it. This was part of the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Professional Wrestling, episode 36. If you go back, we're currently looking at 1995, so if you see any shows you'd like us to have a look at, that's where we're at in our timeline at the moment. I'd like to thank my guests for today, Chelsea Spollen of ShouldersUp.net. Thank you, Mom.
Thanks for having me.
You can find her at Chelsea Comics and at Shoulders_Up. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star, and you can find the show at Troopany Show on Twitter. You can find us at The Troopany Show on Facebook and on Patreon, where you can keep The Troopany Show free forever for everyone. Thank you very much for supporting us, for supporting our show, and thank you for supporting our friends. You can find them on their different Twitter feeds as well. Cy, Alex, Alex, and Marcus. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye!